Hi, Noor. Which title of the hidden books at Berkeley did you like most?
Scrambled Eggs at Midnight. I ripped out the book page laughing, so yeah, that was a good one.
Drei, zwei, eins, here we go!
Also ich sag mal, kontrolliert gestorben. Ist egal, wie langsam oder schnell man läuft, der Lauf ist einfach brutal. Brutal geil.
So, I almost lost my lunch on the streets of Champagne-Lac.
Cola rein bis zum Anschlag und einfach weitermachen.
Man denkt sich das zwischendurch. Denkt man sich, wenn ich ankomme, dann falle ich einfach um und schlafe erstmal oder so.
Can you pound a coke?
No, I ate too much at the last aid station.
What?
When I took over the lead so early, I was like, I just thought it's not good.
Pretty much all my training was just steep up, steep down.
He's setting the crowd on fire, ladies and gentlemen, Kilian Jordan!
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Trailfunk. My name is Christian. And today we have another interview episode in English. I'm speaking with Dutch trail runner Noor van der Veen. I first noticed Noor last year when she won the Tour des Géants in the second fastest time ever by a woman. Back then I thought, wow, someone from the Netherlands wins a race with that much elevation gain. Pretty fascinating. And then just a few days ago, I saw that Noor started at the Berkeley Marathons. A race that, as she wrote afterwards, was even harder than the worst stories she heard before. Plenty of material for a podcast. With that being said, hello and welcome to the show, Noor van der Veen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for taking the time for us. How are you feeling 2 weeks post-race?
I'm feeling very good. Physically, I didn't go as deep as I expected. I was prepared for 60 hours and I only got 14. So physically really good. Mentally, actually the same. I'm very happy to have experienced this. It's been a really, really incredible experience. I've had some time to reflect and it's only made my motivation for training bigger. Just training for Berkeley, but also training for my other goals. It's so inspiring to feel at something I would never have thought that.
And I heard you talk about Berkeley in another podcast, and I think you said you had some kind of niggle in the ankle. Is that an injury you took from Tennessee with you back home?
No, so unfortunately, I sprained my ankle pretty badly at the end of December. And initially, it was good. So I continued running and I ran Berkeley with it. But after Berkeley, it was really thick and I sprained it again and I sprained it a few times before Berkeley as well. So my physio said that we had to figure out what was wrong with it. And it turns out I ripped one of the tendons in my ankle. But apparently you can still run Berkeley with that. And now I have to, definitely spend some time to strengthen the ankle again. But I can still run. So, yeah, it's good news and bad news, I think.
Okay. So I definitely want to talk about Berkeley today. But before we do that, I think we should kind of try to introduce you to our German-speaking audience a bit. And I was thinking maybe I'll just ask you directly. Who is Noor van der Veen?
I'm a runner from the Netherlands. Would say more maybe, or yeah, it's changing. I would say a climber who started running a few years ago, but I think I'm more a runner with a climbing background now. I have a background in mountaineering, and I started running during COVID when the borders were closed and the climbing gyms were closed and I was just looking for something to do. And over the last 5-6 years, it has grown into something that I'm doing professionally now, which is really crazy to say.
So you basically started running like 5 years ago, is that right?
Yeah. I was running like twice a week, maybe 5 kilometers, just to stay fit a little bit, but I was focusing on climbing all the time. And yeah, in the first lockdown, I just started running 3-4 times a week. And then, yeah, actually having running goals instead of climbing goals. So yeah, that changed.
I think that's pretty incredible because you're still new to the sport, I guess. And you're very successful at it. I saw that your third ever trail race was 100K in Andorra. And it's 2022, I think, you ran that race. And it's a race, you know, it's quite difficult. It's known to be very technical. Mm-hmm. What drew you to those difficult long distances right at the start of your running career?
Yeah, so I think as a mountaineer, I was already very familiar with the mountains and with long mountain days, long and hard mountain days. And during my first ever ultra in the mountains, I realized that ultra running in the mountains is pretty similar to what I had been doing before. Only you don't have to carry the heavy weight, which made it easy for me to go uphill. And I really like the technical terrain as well, because I'm used to that from my climbing days as well. So when I selected my first 100 kilometer race, which was the race in Andorra, I was looking for something that was a real mountain race. I really like a loop. I like to do a race that, yeah, just looks good on the map. And that one appealed to me because you basically run through the whole country. But yeah, it was a lot harder. Like that, I think that was one of the hardest races I've ever done. And from these experiences, I think you learn. So yeah, I for sure had some difficulties during that race. I think at 60, 70 kilometers, I was ready to quit. But then, yeah, I think we all have this experience. A nice aid station volunteer gave me some food, gave me some drinks, said some nice words, and I was able to finish it. But it was definitely not an easy experience, but for sure a very beautiful one, and I learned a lot there.
Not an easy experience, very hard. But what made you come back to the sport, to another race?
Yeah, the funny thing is actually this is a nice story because that race was really hard. I had basically lied on the ground with self-pity at some point, and yeah, was not the experience that I was looking for. But then a few weeks later, we were in the Alps, in Italy, and we were just running like a little trail run for training, and we were having drinks at a mountain hut, and a guy started talking to us, and he turned out to be the race director of a race in that same valley, a 90-kilometer race, and he invited us to participate because they don't have many international runners there. And he had 90 kilometers or 35 kilometers, I think. And at first, we both thought, my boyfriend and I, let's do 35. Why not? Sounds like fun. But then the night before, I thought, no, I want a little revenge. And I want to see if I actually learn something in Andorra and apply these lessons to another long race. So I signed up for the 90 kilometers and with the idea to start really slowly and manage everything really well, take care of my body really well, take care of eating and drinking. And the weather wasn't great, so I also made this agreement with myself to actually wear my rain jacket when it was necessary, stuff like that, and not focus on position or speed. So I started all the way in the back, and in the end, I made my way to the front and I won the race, which was something that I never expected to happen at that point. It was the first race that I ever won, and it was a huge surprise. But really nice way, I think, to have a little revenge on my experience in Andorra and also come out stronger.
Nice. That was not the only race you've won. So from your perspective, what are your three biggest sporting achievements in trail running so far?
I think, not trail running, but running in general, I would still say, I mean, the obvious answer, I think, would maybe be the FKT I ran in the Pyrenees and the win in the Tour de Géant, but sometimes I still feel like my first 5 kilometers, like couch to 5K, that's still one of the biggest achievements in my life. Sports never came easy to me when I was younger, and I think I had more difficulty running my first 5 kilometers than having the successes that I have now, because I have experience, I have knowledge, I have a really good team of people around me who help me with everything. But yeah, that was not the case in the beginning. You just have to start moving and work yourself through these really hard first months of running. So sometimes I still feel like that's the biggest sporting achievement of my life. But yeah, if you look at it from a competitive point of view, I think winning Tour de Géant would be on top there.
In what way has sport not come easy to you in your youth?
I was just not into sports. I was into horse riding. I spent a lot of time at the stables between the horses, which was fun, but it's not sports. And I was, I don't know. I just like the regular interpretation of what sports is as a child. It's like throwing and catching a ball, for example, or sprinting. That stuff never came easy to me, so I didn't like it. In school, you have sports lessons, but yeah, I was always the last to get picked on the teams, stuff like that. So just not a very positive relationship with movement or with sports, and I was just not interested in it. Also, when I got a bit older, I also gained quite a bit of weight, so it became even harder to start moving. So I think, I started like running, trying this first five kilometers when I was maybe 21 or something. Yeah, and it was really hard because I had no experience with sports or movement or breathing at all. So yeah, I had to come from a very, very far place to actually make it to the first 5 kilometers. But over the past 11 years, I've completely reworked that experience and that relationship with sports. And I'm happy I did that.
I think that's very interesting, because you have to have some kind of talent, and you just discovered it later in life, not as a child, but after all, you noticed that you have some sort of talent, right?
Yeah, I still find that very hard to admit, because my whole identity is still shaped around the idea, because this is going back such a long time, that I'm not good at sports. I believe that for so long, and now I have to accept the fact that there is a part of sports is you can interpret sports and sports talent very broadly, and I can maybe not sprint, but I'm apparently someone who's very good at endurance stuff, or extreme endurance at least, and that's something that's still quite strange for me to realize, that there's something that I'm actually good at. But with everything that happened over the past 2 years, it's also hard to deny that there is some kind of talent. Sometimes I feel like I'm doing everything similar to other people who are into ultra running, and it just works out really well on my side. So I'm very happy to have discovered that.
We started to talk about some of your achievements, and I read that you're still the fastest Dutch woman ever to have run the UTMB. Is that right? Sounds pretty impressive.
Well, I think it's right. It's a small sport. It's a small country. And I don't know how impressive that actually is, but it's a nice little detail. I'm hoping to improve on my own time next summer, coming summer.
Nice. We'll talk about the coming season later. So I did a bit of research about you, of course, and I scrolled all the way down your Instagram feed. And the first photo you posted is from May 13, 2015.
Nice.
Do you happen to remember what that was?
No, maybe you can help me. Something with cycling, probably.
Yeah, so it's not a mountain scenery, but it's like a wide field with flowers. Mm-hmm. Pretty classic Netherlands, I would say. All that's missing is a windmill, maybe.
Yeah.
But you were apparently on a bike tour, and I mm-hmm. found that picture quite symbolic of kind of what's special about you as an athlete, because you come from a region with no mountains mm-hmm. at all, and yet you're so successful at what you do. How do you explain that?
I think the picture you're talking about is funny because it's from this period we just talked about when I started moving, and I think I first started cycling before I started running. But yeah, I soon after joined the climbing club, and from that move, I got into mountaineering, and yeah, skip forward a few years, I was deep into mountaineering, let's say. I was part of an expedition team training for an expedition in Kyrgyzstan to climb mountains that hadn't been climbed before. But this is an endurance sport, but it's also an uphill sport. So it's always been the question, how do you train for something like that when you live in the Netherlands? I think I've been thinking about moving to the Alps for a long time, but yeah, my life is here and my friends are here. My family is here. I work here. My boyfriend works here. So it's not always easy to do that. Although many Dutch mountaineers or people who are into mountain sports do move to the mountains. It's also interesting to find a solution to that problem. And I think if you're creative, you can come a very long way. But for me personally, going uphill has never really been the problem for some reason. Yeah, I'm strong in the uphills. So when I'm training for mountain races, running, sometimes I feel like it's actually a benefit to live in the Netherlands because I have this climbing background, and the uphills aren't the problem, but the actual running is something that I can still improve on. And living in a flat country forces me to run a bit more. So I do train on like the uphill treadmill, for example, but I also train flat running. I think 50% of my training when I'm in the Netherlands. And yeah, I still believe that's where I can make the biggest improvements. So yeah, as time progresses, I've started to realize that maybe living here might be a blessing in disguise, even if I've been wanting or wishing to move to the mountains for a long time. And then part of the answer is also that I spend a lot of time in the mountains because especially, yeah, the training for technical terrain, training for downhill running, that's very hard in the Netherlands. So part of the time I go to Belgium where you have longer downhills already. And I think like 3 or 4 months a year, I'm just in the mountains to train. So that's the honest answer as well. It's really hard, I think, to perform in mountain races at a high level if you never go to the mountains to train. But I can for sure improve living here. I'm convinced of that now.
A year consists of 12 months. How many months do you spend in the mountains and how many at home in the Netherlands?
Yeah, it's always increasing. Feeling very privileged to be able to go to the mountains, basically, when I feel like it. We have a camper van, which makes it easier as well. But I think I spent, yeah, last year, I spent maybe in total 4 or 5 months in the mountains. The whole summer, starting in June, ending after Tour de Géant, so half September. And then around that, we spend weeks in May, in February. I always go on a winter holiday in December as well. So yeah, whenever we can, basically. And yeah, as it's part of my job now, which still feels crazy to say, yeah, I have the privilege to go a bit more.
Juliane, sag mal, was ist das eigentlich für schicke neue Trail-Ausrüstung, die du momentan immer beim Laufen trägst?
Seit wann fällt dir denn auf, was ich anhabe? Aber schön, dass du nachfragst, denn ich habe eine neue Marke für mich entdeckt. Raab, R-A-B geschrieben. Wobei, so neu ist die Marke auch wieder nicht. Die gibt's schon seit 1981. Die ist damit also älter als du.
Ja, aber auch nicht so viel älter.
Naja, Raab hat jedenfalls eine neue Trailrunning-Kollektion entwickelt, die sich an Mountain People richtet.
Mountain People, oh, das klingt ja schon mal cool. Da hast du dich natürlich gleich angesprochen gefühlt.
Exakt, was soll ich sagen? Ich liebe die Sachen einfach total. Angefangen bei der Vail-Weste, die wahrscheinlich bequemste Laufweste aller Zeiten. Oder die Phantom-Jacket, die so leicht ist, dass man sie kaum spürt. Eine echte Phantomjacke halt. Was mir am besten gefällt, ist, dass die Teile nicht nur voll Hightech und für die allerhöchsten Ansprüche gemacht sind, sondern auch echt stylisch aussehen. Irgendwie dezent und richtig cool eben.
Okay, jetzt bin ich neugierig geworden. Zeig mal her. Mhm. Okay, die ist ja echt federleicht. 115 Gramm in Größe M und komplett wasserdicht mit einer 20.000er Wassersäule. Krass, das finde ich mal eine Ansage.
Ja, finde ich auch. Ich kann Raab jedenfalls nur empfehlen und werde die Sachen auch beim nächsten Rennen tragen. Wenn ihr mehr wissen wollt, gibt es mehr Infos unter www.raab.equipment, also raab.equipment. Den Link findet ihr auch in den Shownotes.
Sehr gut, und jetzt geht's weiter mit dem Podcast. So there's a movie about you on YouTube, and it's about your FKT in the Pyrenees, and it's a very cool movie. I would recommend everyone to watch it. I will put the link into the show notes.
Thank you.
And something stuck out to me because I thought, man, you have to be a very confident person to do something like that, you know, start a 700 plus kilometer race, 25,000 meters of elevation, nonstop running, kind of only very little sleep. But you said something in the movie that I remembered, and it's something like you said you're not a very confident person in everyday life,
mm-hmm.
but those running projects, they kind of help you build that inner confidence. I thought that was very interesting. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Yeah. When I try to reflect on that, I always think it's a bit strange because I feel very inconfident a lot of time, but I also, and I don't know what this is about my brain, but I also am super curious about finding out where my limits are. So I don't necessarily think that I can do anything, but I'm interested to find out. And with this FKT project, which was, yeah, by definition, something that you cannot really try before you actually do it. You'll just have to go for it and figure out if you can do it. Yeah, that was very interesting because I had run 100 kilometers or 100 miles before, but I had never run it the same distance the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. So, yeah, going in, you're not sure if you can even do it, and it's strange having a camera team there, having a whole crew that's going to support you when you never know for sure how things will go. But I think that's also the interesting side of it, and in a way their presence made it more real to me and more I had to commit to it, which was nice because it's easy also to have an idea and think about could I do it, but yeah, having agreements with a camera team that they are going to be there at that place at that moment, it also forces you to go through with it. So in the end, I really liked the fact that we arranged it in that way and that we had them there to capture it, because it forced me to go through with the question and with the curiosity of, can I actually run the length of the Pyrenees if I want to? And the answer, yeah, was quite, I think the most interesting moment was the first morning. So after the first day, that's, for me, it was the moment of truth. You know, you wake up after, I think I ran 105 kilometers on the first day. And you wake up and that's when you have to do it again. And yeah, that was the moment of truth. But yeah, I woke up, felt not super refreshed, but definitely ready to go again. And the second day was a lot of fun, and the third day as well. So yeah, you quickly find out that you are actually capable of doing such a thing. And then you build on that experience and you take it into the next day and into the next day. And through these experiences, yeah, you learn to sometimes just trust your body and just go for it and find out how it goes. Because, yeah, you've probably also seen in the film that at some point I crash because my body is just saying no. I probably had some bad water to drink from a mountain stream. We don't know for sure, of course, but things went wrong. And then even then, if you set your mind to it, you can still continue. And I was able to finish it because I just really wanted to find out where that limit was. And I thought I had reached it halfway. But yeah, even then, after a good night of sleep, it turns out that you can continue if you want to.
Yeah, and you managed to push through. And I think you finished in about 10 days and 11 hours or something. Pretty impressive time. And you said in the end, when you were standing in the ocean, you said that I didn't really know what I was starting. And that, I think, kind of suggests a kind of carefree attitude that you have. And or maybe you could call it even being a little bit naive, you know. So there's the saying, ignorance is bliss. Would you say that's a useful trait for ultra running?
Yes and no, I think. In a way, for sure. I don't know if, for example, Barkley, knowing what I know now, it makes it harder. I think even reading all the stories, watching all the films, you don't really know what you get yourself into. And then you're actually in the terrain and you realize it's still a lot harder, even if all the stories were already pretty grueling. So in that sense, ignorance isn't bliss. But on the other hand, having that knowledge also allows me to prepare better. So yeah, it's yes and no. If I would commit to training for Barkley again, I'm for sure a lot less naive now. I know what it takes, and I know that it is going to be extremely hard for anyone at this moment with this new course to even finish a full run. Also from personal experience, to even finish the first loop within the cutoff time. If I commit to it, I know what I'm committing to, and I know what I still need to work on in order to be successful there, or to be more successful at least. So yeah, yes and no.
But it seems like you're able to kind of convince yourself before a big effort like that, that it won't be that hard. So I think that's pretty useful, you know. If you think about how long a Tour de Jean is and how sleepy you will be in the end and stuff like mm-hmm. that, probably won't even start.
Don't know if you recognize this as well, but your memory is also very selective, right? So you remember the good times, but not the bad ones, or at least they don't feel as bad anymore as time progresses. So yeah, with Tour de Géant as well, I think with the experience that I have now with running Tour before, I think I could do better there if I would go back. And I'm also tempted to do that because that fascinates me, the improvement over time and perfectioning the execution of the race. I have a memory of the moments that I felt bad, but I cannot feel how bad it actually was. You know, I just remember it, but it doesn't feel as bad. Whereas like the good memories, I can still feel them in my body. And when I think about them, I just start smiling. So I think that's also, just the flaws of our memory, which help there.
Okay, so before we get to the Barkley, let's talk just a little bit about the tour. What goals did you have going into the Tour de Géant last year?
I had the FKT in the Pyrenees was 7 weeks before. So initially I just thought I'm going to sign up and I will see how the recovery goes and if I will even start tour, because I think my health and my recovery is very important and I don't take that lightly. I think many people who run these long distances and many people who are at the start line of the tour, a lot of things in the summer. And I think I spoke to quite a few people who had done Swiss Peaks, right? Like two weeks before, for example. But that's not how I look at things. I when I do something and when I invest all the time and energy into it, I want to do it well. So I signed up, but I wasn't sure if I was going to start. But then recovery went okay. I slept for 2 weeks, I think, and then started walking, started running, and yeah, started feeling like myself again. I had, I think, 4 weeks left for tour. So yeah, I wasn't going to have a huge training block anymore, but I could for sure at least see the course a little bit, train on the course, and yeah, get familiar with all the segments. So that's what I did. And running all the segments, or I didn't run the full course, but I think 50-60%, I had a clear idea of what the challenge was going to be like and what the terrain was like. So I made a time plan for myself, and it was 79 hours and a half, exactly the time that I actually ran. So I realized that that could be a winning time, but you never really know what the other women are going to do. And I didn't really think about winning it. I just thought about executing it well. But then I got sick, like 1.5 weeks out from tour. I had a really bad flu, might even have been COVID. I'm not sick often, but this time it was really bad, and it just wouldn't get better. When I even just walked, I would just start coughing, and this didn't go away until like the day before the start. So yeah, that changed, I think, the whole perspective on the race. I even started thinking about not starting. But together with my team, we discussed it, and we decided to get started anyway, because I was for sure improving. And yeah, we could always quit if I wasn't able to perform to my standard. But yeah, it went quite well, actually, and I just enjoyed myself. I was moving relatively easy. So yeah, we just decided to continue. It went exactly as you would expect, I think, going into it like that. So first few days were all right, and the last day this flu got the better of me. So last day was really surviving. I started coughing again, lots of mucus and yeah, stuff. So really trying not to choke and making it to the finish line. But it's quite funny to think about the fact that I ran the exact same time as I had projected. And I think if I would be fully healthy, I would be interested in seeing what I could actually do on that course.
So running that 770K FKT 7 weeks before, did that make you feel like the tour is like a short race, even like a walk in the park?
Yeah, in a way, at least like the second half, I remember clearly thinking it's only 140 kilometers left, you know? So that's quite strange to think, but it's really how it felt. I had, like, on the last day in the Pyrenees, I had run 150 kilometers in order to make it in time to the ocean to still get the overall FKT. And that was really hard. I think that's probably one of the hardest running things I've ever done. So running in the same state, like being a bit sick again in the tour, and having 140 kilometers left, I could just really build on that experience and that confidence that I had done that before. And that if you just keep like going and putting your left foot in front of your right, you will make it, and you can still make it as the first. Because yeah, my speed doesn't really go down even if I feel that bad. So I think the Pyrenees FKT for sure helped with the experience in the tour. I was also dreaming about, like, while I was running in the Pyrenees, I had to go to bed every night, but I really liked running in the night. So I was already dreaming about running tour when I was in the Pyrenees and not having to stop for the night and just being able to continue and push through the night. I really enjoyed that. So I tried to enjoy that while I was actually running the tour as well.
And could you on the last day of the tour kind of relax a bit? Because I think your lead was about 2 to 3 hours before the second woman and the third place woman, they were pretty close to each other. So they were chasing you. Did you still feel that kind of pressure until the end, or were you able to relax and say, okay, I got this?
Yeah, it was funny because I think I took over the lead maybe 100 kilometers before the finish. It was my coach was my crew that day, and we made a really tactical move, or some tactical moves, in order to be able to do that. It was not something that just happened. We planned that really well. And when I took over the lead, I think I pushed for 4 hours in order to build up the lead, that they wouldn't be able to see me anymore, and that I would be that far away. And it worked out, but you don't have phone connection, so you don't really know that at that point. So we went into the third night, and I saw headlamps behind me all the time, but you don't know if it's the second and the third woman. On the descent to a larger aid station, a life base, I remember like running really fast because I thought she was right on my heels, and then it turned out to be a man. So when I got to the life base, my coach was able to tell me that I had a 4-hour lead, which was, on the one hand, it's nice to hear that, and on the other hand, I think it would have been better if you would have told me like you have a 1-hour lead, for example. So it's comfortable, but it's not too comfortable. You know, a 4-hour lead is so comfortable that you find it hard to push after that. But I was able to go to bed for an hour, which was also, well, I think a much needed hour of sleep, which was great. And then, the flu or whatever it was also took over. So it was just survival. So it was, good to have that long of a lead.
Okay. From a race execution standpoint, it really looks like that was the kind of perfect race because, 79 and a half hours, your projected time, it's kind of just what you ran, but you were still sick, as you said. So was that a perfect race? Is there even something like that? Is there a perfect race? Can there be one?
Yeah. So apart from the being sick still and a little bit at the end, for sure, I think this is one of the best executed races I ever ran. And I was, I'm very happy to have had, it was the first time that my coach actually came over. So usually we discuss the race plan and then I just do it and someone crews me, like my boyfriend, for example, but he's not really invested in the tactics of the race. He takes care of me really well, but the tactics I've discussed with my coach beforehand and I just have to do it on my own. But this time he was there, and that made a huge difference because we could continuously discuss and adapt on the go. So I had a conscious slow start. First half of the race, I was I think I was 16th woman or something, so not at all in the picture, just doing my thing, because with the tour it's so long, you have to actually survive the first half and get through it without ruining your body too much. The highest goal is also in the first part, and it's in the first night. It's almost, I forgot how high it is, but it's, I think, nearly 3,000 meters. And it's really easy to like with the cold air in the night and the altitude to trash your lungs. So for me, it was a very conscious decision to go slow there. And we realized that it wasn't necessary to push until the final part. So I think I was also taking over the first woman at the Rifugio della Barma, which is, I think, 200 or 250 kilometers into the race. And that was just too early for me to lead it. I felt like it's going to be a waste of my energy if I lead the race already. So I went to bed and I gave away the lead. I had a good hour of sleep. And then, took over the lead later in the race at a moment when I thought the time was right. So in terms of tactics, I was very satisfied with it. For sure would like to do that when I feel 100%.
So let's imagine you run Tor again and the conditions are similar to last year, which were pretty ideal, I guess.
Mm-hmm, yeah, they were great.
What kind of time do you think is possible for you?
Well, I think the men are already down at 65 or something, 65 hours. And there's no reason why a women's time should be high in the 70s. I think if men can run 65, I think women, if you do like a 10% performance gap, yeah, could do low 70s or even below 70 hours. I for sure think a woman could do that. Having seen the course and having raced it myself, I know many instances where I wasted time or when I could be better. So it would be nice to, but I don't know if I could do it, but I would be tempted to try going under 70 hours. Would take a lot of work and have to work for really hard for a really long time, but I think a woman could do it, and I would be tempted to give it a try myself.
I think that's a pretty good segue to Barkley Marathons, because we all saw Jasmine Paris finish the Barkley Marathons as the first woman ever in 2024, mm-hmm. It was, I think.
Yeah.
And did that inspire you to really get to that start line as well?
Yeah, massively, of course. I think many women all over the world were inspired. But for me as well, I was so happy when she did that. I had been following Jasmine for a few years after she won the Spine, I think, outright. And I just knew she was the one who could do it. So yeah, I wasn't very much very interested in Barkley before, but when she started doing it, my interest in the race grew as well. And then when she actually did it, I had just run my first really long ultra as well. So 275 kilometers, I think 52 hours or something. So yeah, a race of a similar length, at least in hours. And it went really well. I really enjoyed it, being in nature for 3 days without any distractions from real life, so to say. So yeah, definitely her finish was very inspiring to me. I think that's the moment when I decided that I wanted to see if I could find the way into Barkley, and finally found it.
Okay, so I think most listeners know about Barkley, the Barkley Marathons, but I guess a few people might have not heard of it, and they are scratching their head right now. What is she talking about? I guess running is just one piece of the puzzle. What else is required of you during the Barkley?
Yeah, so for those who don't know what the Barkley is, it's a race in Tennessee in the USA where you go off trail straight through the woods. So I think you'd have to have good skills at running off trail. There's lots of, like, there's wood, there's roots, there's leaves that are slippery, mud. And you'd have to be fast. And the uphills are extremely steep. Some of them are 50%. Most of them actually are. So you have to have upper body strength in order to use your pulse to get up. And then you'd have to have the footwork to get down them in one piece and in a relatively good time. You have to have navigation skills because it's not marked. And you don't have any electronics with you. So you don't have a GPX watch. You cannot have a phone. You can only use a map and a compass to know where you are. And then you also need to have, I think you need to be intelligent to begin with, because it's quite complicated. Actually, you have a course description that is very cryptical. So you have to be able to read and remember the course description, and from that understand where you can find the checkpoints, which are books hidden in the woods for those who don't know. And you have to rip out a page in order to prove that you've been at that place. So you first have to have like the broader navigational skills to broadly follow the course, and then you have to be able to be good at like the searching for the actual book. and do all of that, you don't have much time. You know, there's no margin. There's no margin for error. So you have to make decisions in split seconds. So you have to have a certain level of confidence in order in your own navigational skills in order to be able to make those decisions fast and make them right. You have to eat and drink at the same time. And you have to do all of that for 60 hours. So yeah, it takes a huge toll on the brain. Apart from the body, it's physically, it's really hard. But the brain is just working for 60 hours straight and there's no time to sleep. So I think some people who are good at barkey are able to stay sharp in the later stages of the race as well, because otherwise you just get horribly lost.
And yeah, we talked about ultra running being a confidence builder for you. So has the Tour race given you enough confidence to think, okay, now I'm ready for the Barkley?
Yeah, so I applied to Barkley already the year before. So that was also before Tour. But I didn't get in. And yeah, having the experience in the Pyrenees and in Tour for sure made me feel that Barkley could be something that I could be good at, because I just had this experience this summer where I, yeah, was just going, able to keep going and going and going without slowing down so much. Yeah, so that's gave me some confidence towards Barkley. But having the experience that I've had now at Barkley, I also realized that Barkley asked for a lot more than just that.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so I made a huge navigational error, which was very instructive in itself. I've had some time to reflect on it. And I think just making that mistake and reflecting on it already makes me a better navigator, because, yeah, I just made some beginner mistakes. When I learned I got into Barkley, I had to, I mean, I knew the basics of navigation with a compass and a map, of course, but it's so different to do it in the middle of the woods, in the middle of the night. So I, yeah, spent all winter trying to fine-tune my navigation skills. But I think you'd have to make these really big mistakes as well and reflect on them in order to actually be good at it. And that just takes time and experience. So the actual experience at Barkley and what went wrong is already very instructive. And I hope, yeah, I will be able to work with these things this year in order to start, if they'll have me, of course, a little better prepared on that side next year. But yeah, Barkley, I was surprised by how explosive it really is. So I'm a good endurance athlete, and for sure it's an endurance race, but the hills are so steep that I would also, I think, change my, like, alter my training a little bit towards explosive uphill running. I think I focused a bit too much on the endurance side of things, but you'd have to be really fast uphill in order to make it on this course, the new course that everyone talks about. So yeah, many things that I'd have to improve on. But you can only learn and realize that when you are actually there.
That sounds so horrible and fascinating at the same time. So I kind of think that, you know, many runners who get drawn into this Barkley universe, they really get obsessed about it. And maybe you have to become obsessed about it for a couple of years to be able to finish it. And did that happen to you? Would you say you are obsessed now?
Yes, I was already obsessed with the Barkley, but I don't think I really understood, even if I was already obsessed, I don't really think I understood what the Barkley is really about. And now that I've been there, the obsession has only grown, because I've seen with my own eyes how hard it really is and what level of perfection is required from a runner to be successful there. And yeah, whatever you define as a success, for me, I think I viewed success at Barkley as a finish before, and very few people have been able to finish the Barkley. So that was something that attracted me. The question, like, what made their run stand out from the rest, and why were they successful, and why are so many people unsuccessful there? And yeah, also the question, could I be successful in that sense? But now I've seen what it takes, and I was able to do the first loop, but not within the time limit. I realize how hard it actually is, and how much should go right and how little can go wrong. That I got even more respect for the challenge, and I define success very differently. So yeah, if I would go back, just being able to execute everything from minute to minute well and right and in a respectable time in order to make it to the next book and the next and the next and the next. That in itself is something that I find very fascinating and want to be able to do better next time and see where that takes me. But finishing is, I think, the ultimate result of that, of being able to do that for 60 hours. But yeah, just getting further than I got last time, that's something that inspires me now, and not making the mistakes that I made, and see how far I could get with all the knowledge and with all the things that I learned. That's something that drives me now.
I guess the veterans, the so-called veterans of the Barkley, the finishers, they play a pretty important role in passing down the advice. And have you asked Jasmine Paris for advice yourself?
No, not Jasmine, because I don't know her personally. And I also heard that she had a baby, I think, right before the Barkley, or at least in the period that I learned that I was going to run the Barkley. So I thought, let's not disturb her there. But I definitely asked veterans that were more close to me. So Dutch veterans, Belgian veterans, and I also was in contact with Aurélien Sanchez, so the first French Barkley finisher. I've been in touch with veterans before the race, which was great because they were able to give me all the information that they had, and I was able to study the previous courses already, so I knew a little bit what the course might look like, because they don't change it fully. They always change like small parts of it, but not the whole course. And read the course descriptions from earlier years. So yeah, that was very, very instructive. But I think if I would go back next time, I might also see like who of the veterans are coming to the race, and maybe see if I can make a little team ahead of the race. That's what the French runners did this year, and I think that's what set them out from the rest. They were working together like that.
Would you say that if you start again at the Barkley, would you have to train even harder and more, or just train differently this time?
Both. Yeah, both. I think I did everything I could, being a virgin and with the knowledge that I had. I think we prepared really well, but you don't really know what you're preparing for, because you can talk to veterans, but it's still something you have to experience yourself. Like I said, I think I would focus more on explosive uphill running, for example, rather than just endurance, or just making lots of elevation. Make sure that I have this explosive power to go up fast. And I think, in a way, I will have to train harder. Physically, I will need to be more fit. But in a way, it will also be easier, because part of the reason why the preparation for this Barkley was so hard was that you have to prepare on so many levels that like the logistical preparation, I can just copy paste to next year. I would go to the same Airbnb. I would go, like stuff like a rental car. So yeah, just the travel part of going to the USA will be easier. I have all the maps. I can just copy paste many things. So I think that leaves some time and energy to focus on the things that I know really matter now. And also I have more time to prepare. Because if I decide for myself right now that I want to be better at Barclay, I can basically start tomorrow. If they don't let me in, maybe that would have been a pity, but I don't think it's a waste of time and energy, because I think it will help me grow as an ultra runner, even if I don't get to go back to Barclay. But if I do get to go back to Barclay, I have many more months of preparation now. Last year, I only had 4 or 3 even.
How many months before the actual race do the runners get the invitation or the letter of condolences, I guess?
Yeah, so I don't want to share too much of that because it's nice that the process is a little secretive, I think. But you hear it at the end of the year, the last quarter of the year. But this year, the Barclay was a month earlier. So usually it's somewhere in the middle of March or at the end of March. And this year it was halfway February. So that made it 1 month less preparation.
So you have to kind of gamble a little bit and train as if you knew you were being selected.
Yeah, but I don't view it as gambling anymore. So my initial reaction was disappointment, of course, when I wasn't able to continue for the second loop. I felt disappointed for all the time and energy I had dedicated to the Barclay and then not even being able to do the first loop within the cutoff time. And it felt like a waste of time, but now I don't view it like that at all. I had some time to reflect, and it's been a huge learning opportunity and a huge life experience as well, in terms of how do you work your way around failure? How do you take lessons from something like that? That I don't view it as a gamble if I would dedicate even more time to the Barclay anymore, because I feel like I can only learn and grow from the process.
What specifically did you learn from the Barclay? Because I think maybe it is because most people DNF this year, everyone DNF'd. It kind of forces you to reconsider the definition of success and failure a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty interesting about the race. So what kind of lessons did you learn?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the thing. So for me, I had only been relatively successful in everything I did when it came to running. It was a relatively smooth career, if you can call it that. I hadn't really experienced failure yet. So I think I also came into the Barclay a bit naive, thinking that this might be something that I might be good at. And of course, I prepared really well, but I had never really thought about the scenario where I would be cut off from the race in the first loop. So maybe in the second or the third, but never the first. And that was just a really interesting, I would say, even life experience, where you have expectations and things don't turn out the way you expect they will. And how do you deal with that? And how do you accept the fact that that happened? Because you cannot change it anymore. At first I felt like, but I want to do a second loop. You know, I came all the way to Tennessee. I want to do a second loop, but you're just not allowed to. And those are just real, really interesting basic life lessons about expectations and how things turn out. But I also realized that failure is just so much more interesting than success. Sometimes I struggle talking about my successes because we just talked about Tor. It was interesting because it wasn't a perfect race. There's still something to talk about, but success, I don't know how to talk about it as well. Whereas failure, you can just talk about everything that went wrong and what you would do differently next time. And I realized that this is something that I actually probably needed at this point in my running career, if I may call it like that, where I would just be put, right at the place where I belong and, go back to the drawing board and come back, better prepared next time. That inspires me, I think, much more than any success I ever had. I'm someone who always wants to do well, but that doesn't mean that I cannot deal with failure. I think this failure, if I may call it like that, is something that just gives me more fire and that forces me to be smart and reflect and not be a stupid runner who just trains and trains and trains, but take the time to actually think about what happened and make deliberate choices in my preparation for next year if I get to go back.
Yeah, I think that's special about the Barkley. It kind of makes everyone very small, or it humbles you. It humbles everyone. It doesn't matter what kind of races you did before, because Barkley is so different. I think that's can be pretty healthy for a human being, right? To be humbled in this way. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's beautiful, I think, about Barkley. It's funny that the whole world is trying to figure out what's going on in the woods in Tennessee at that weekend, but you're really just there with maybe 100 people, with like 40 runners, crew, and some media people, and some people of the organization, and that's it. And you're just sitting there in the woods barbecuing while some people are running around. But some of those runners are some of the biggest names in trail running. For example, Mathieu Blanchard was also there this year. And it was so nice to see how being a Barkley virgin, so a first timer, makes everyone, you have to start somewhere. And I think he also prepared incredibly well. He was with the French team. He's obviously physically super fit. He was probably the fittest person on the start line. He prepared well. You could see that he was really trying to learn on the first loop. And the other French people who had been there before were showing him where the books were, how the course was best, which were the best lines on the course. He probably has a great shot at finishing one day, but even he, I think he also had to learn maybe the hard way about the weather in Frozen Head. I think he talked about being hypothermic because the weather really changed in the second and third loop, and he had to abandon his attempts because he was just getting too cold. And there's lessons for everyone there, no matter your CV or your name. And I think that's beautiful about the Barkley.
So will you keep trying to be a finisher, or would maybe next time a fun run be enough? Enough of a success?
Yeah, it's interesting because people are philosophizing about the question if this current course of the Barkley is finishable at all. They added after the year Jasmine finished, in that same year four other men also finished, and the year before we had three finishers. They drastically changed the course. They added two extra climbs and descents, adding about, people say 1.5 hours to the course, times five, because you have to do five loops, means at least 7.5 hours of extra running. Whereas earlier, finishers never had more than an hour left on the clock. I think Jasmine had 80 or 90 seconds left on 60 hours. So that gives an idea of how difficult the current course is. Do I believe it's impossible to finish? No, I don't. I think someone like Mathieu could really be part of the new generation of Barkley runners who will be able to do it. And I heard him speak about making it his life project or a multi-year project. Yeah, which is great. I think he's for sure going to do it one day. So the course isn't unfinishable. I don't know if I will be able to do it. I feel like I didn't get to experience enough of the Barkley because I only was able to do one loop to actually say something about that. I wish I had more time on the course. I wish I had a night on the course as well. We only had a daylight loop, just a little bit of darkness at the end. So it's really hard for me to say. But I think it's always good to strive. Barkley just asks from you to be perfect. So yeah, if you are able to actually do it perfectly, why not? But yeah, it's really hard for me to say if I will be able to finish this course. And it's also become irrelevant to me, actually. I look at Barkley more as a personal quest towards improvement than striving for a finish at this moment. But yeah, the ultimate reward of that is a finish, of course.
Okay, so you said they made the course harder. Would it be possible if the organization sees, okay, this seems to be undoable, that they adjusted it a little bit in the other direction and just make it a little bit easier again? Would that be possible, do you think?
I was hoping they would do that this year. And that was naive in hindsight. So I'm for sure less naive now. I don't think they are going to change it. But yeah, it would be great if... Yeah, I don't know. Would be a good present if they did. But I have decided for myself that I would like to commit to this course. So I don't really care if they do anymore. This is just the reality now. And I think this is the new generation Barkley. And I would like to be part of that generation. So I don't mind if they make it harder or easier anymore. If they keep it like this, which I expect they will, this is what we have to prepare for and what we have to deal with.
So I think it's time to kind of wrap this up. We've talked for an hour now. Maybe let's end with your season planning for this summer. You already said in the beginning that you will toe the line at the UTMB again.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe talk about your plans this year.
Well, like Barkley, I always look for goals that inspire me, and UTMB just continues to inspire me to be better. I've been there twice before. It was my first 100 miles in the mountains, and the year after, I improved significantly on my own time, and I think this is because you have the best competition in the world there. So there's always something to strive for. There's always a woman ahead of you that you can try and catch, which is I think unique in the world of ultra running, and that's why I want to come back to UTMB again, because world-class competition just motivates me and inspires me to be better. See what I can do there this year.
I think the first time you ran UTMB was like 32 hours or something, and the second time you improved by 4 to 5 hours and ended up in the top 20. So yeah, it was a big step.
Yes. I don't know if I can do another 4 to 5 hours. I don't think so, but I'm for sure hoping for a few hours, let's say that.
So you're pretty good at executing a race plan. You probably don't have a race plan for this year's UTMB yet, but if you were allowed to dream right now, is a top 10 finish maybe in the cards for you?
It is the goal, let's say. I think, well, I don't know. We talked about my ankle before, and I just had, the results of the scan, and yeah, like I said, one of the tendons is ripped, so at this moment it feels a bit strange to talk about ranking and position at UTMB when I still have this whole injury journey ahead of me. So but let's say that the injury wasn't there, then I would for sure go and see if I could get myself into the top 10, because I feel like there are So it's 2 years ago since I last ran UTMB. I'm a completely different athlete since. So since 2 years ago. I was still at the beginning of my ultra running journey, and now I've learned so many things, and I just feel like I'm a better athlete. So I would say I could do a lot better there. There's still lots of room for improvement at UTMB. But yeah, with the ankle, it's really hard to say. It feels, it's just, the news that it's actually ripped is so fresh that it's hard to say where the next few months are going to take me. But preparation is not going to be ideal. That's one thing that's for sure.
Okay. But I think you will have at least one opportunity to test out the ankle at the Marathon du Mont Blanc in Chamonix as well. Is that right?
Yes. That was the original plan, yes. Don't know at this moment if that will come too soon. It's still on the calendar at this moment because I don't see the reason to take it off at this point, because I just first will have to see how the coming months will go. But without the injury, so let's just think what if this was a season without the injury, then I would have a stepping stone like Marathon du Mont Blanc on the calendar to test the legs and to get into the racing a little bit faster, racing as well, because last summer I've only done Tour as a serious race, which is a really different kind of race. So I think Marathon du Mont Blanc is a great experience to get into faster racing again. It's still on the calendar, but let's see how things go.
And even before that, but that might be too close now, is the Raab Gappa Trail in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. It's a 26K race, and I think you were supposed to run, or you wanted to run it, but with that injury, I guess we'll have to see, right?
Yes. Also, still on the calendar. Let's see how things go.
Okay. So, Noor, thanks for your time. I wish you all the best for your ankle and then for the rest of the season. And
thank you so much. Yeah,
it was really fun.
It was a nice chatting. Yeah.
Okay.
Speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.